Coming up on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio, cha-ching, five South Suburban Chicago communities hope to land a casino and give Northwest Indiana casinos a run for their money. And the U.S. EPA is giving South Chicago a new Superfund site, and the Cubs have a new manager, and the Bears are, well, you know, they're the Bears. And we just celebrated a very cold and snowy Halloween, but we're not done just yet with skeletons. It's now time for Dia de los Muertos, an annual Mexican tradition that's growing in popularity in the United States, including right here in Northwest Indiana. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, it's official. Five communities in South Suburban Chicago are aiming for that single casino license. The state of Illinois expanded gambling to give the city of Chicago a casino and also one for the South Suburbs. The casinos that are officially in the mix are Matteson, Linwood, Calumet City, and Homewood East Hazelcrest. In just a few minutes, we'll talk to a person who follows the gaming industry in the Midwest. But first, I'm joined by Matteson, Illinois Mayor Sheila Calmers Curran. How you doing, Mayor?
I'm doing well.
Mayor, so obviously you're excited about all this. What can a casino do for the village of Matteson?
Well, first of all, it could generate and promote economic development through the creation of jobs and revenue to the community. The revenue would allow us to enhance the quality of life by improving infrastructure and public safety. Those are just a few of the things that we are looking at how this could benefit. Also offer more options and more opportunities for the region to enjoy a movie theater, dining options, and various family entertainment. So those things are some of the things that we're looking at right now to happen in the region itself.
What is it about your community that you think would be more better suited to house a casino than, say, the other communities?
The village of Matteson is simply the best location in the South Suburb. One of the things that we look at it is 1.3 million live within 30 minutes of the site, and it's perfectly positioned to avoid existing competition. So we're excited about that. No other licensed applicant has a large market draw than the village of Matteson itself.
Is there any concern? It seems like Matteson is far enough away from, say, the existing casinos in Northwest Indiana. Is there any concern about competition from Northwest Indiana casinos?
No, Matteson is the farthest west of any competition, and so I think that's a great factor for us. This site is 30 minutes from any existing casino itself, so it puts us in a great position. And, you know, everyone that has looked at this has looked at the fact that it puts us in just the perfect position itself.
And I understand that the application process, it's already been submitted, but it could take about a year to determine. Is that what they've told you?
Yes, it could take up to a year, and we know that. We're looking at how this will happen and how it will pan out, but we're excited about it. It may take a year, it may take less than a year, but we feel that where we're located with I-57 and 80, that we're just in a perfect location.
Okay, Mayor, thank you so much. I really appreciate speaking with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I look forward to talking to you again when the casino comes to the village of Matteson.
Thank you again to Matteson, Illinois Mayor Sheila Calmers Curran. So does Matteson make the most sense, as the mayor just pointed out, or would Calumet City, which is right next to Hammond and its existing casino, a better fit? Joining me now is Ed Feigenbaum, who covers the gaming industry for Indiana Insight Newsletter, part of the Hanna News Service. Okay, so we have four communities in the South Suburbs of Chicago looking now officially to get a casino. We've talked about in the past, you know, saturation. Does it make sense for, say, a company to build a casino so close to existing casinos, whether they're in Indiana or Illinois?
Well, the first rule of building a casino is location. And obviously, you know, if you've got a good location, there are going to be others that are interested in building there. Everybody thinks that they've got the best property or that they found a particular niche. And, you know, if they can find the financing for it, it's their money. It's not public dollars. It's private dollars. So why not let them do it? The only problem is whether it starts to impinge upon the overall state dollars, or if it starts, for example, as we saw with the video gaming terminals in Illinois, taking away from the casinos at a different tax rate, or if it proves to be just too much Illinois saturation and drives people over to Illinois, literally and figuratively.
We now have so many casinos throughout Indiana, and each of them must offer something to not just attract new customers, but to keep the customers they already have. So let's keep it in state. There has to be casinos that seem to do it better than others. Do you find that casinos in Indiana try to, obviously they want the best product, but how do they differentiate which customers to go after and what products to have out there?
Well, a lot of it depends upon the location, and a lot of it depends upon the company itself. For example, the Caesars property in Hammond, Horseshoe Casino Hammond, prides itself as a horseshoe property on being able to take high-limit bets, being able to take a little bit more risk than other casinos in a given market, and particularly in the Chicago area. So they appeal to the high roller. They have an entertainment venue called The Venue, to which they bring in some extremely good entertainment options, and those may include both concerts and sporting events. They have mixed martial arts features there. They bring in entertainment reviews such as Thunder Down Under, which appeals to the women who might not otherwise frequent a casino. And if you've got the ability to use that facility for the World Series of Poker, which they bring in and which attracts a significant audience from the Chicago area and which also introduces new players to the casino. The Horseshoe Casino Hammond and Ameristar Casino East Chicago are both parts of bigger casino networks, and that also helps because they have player rewards programs, and the Caesars Reward Program is essentially recognized as being not only the first, but the best in the business. And the rewards that they offer allow people to build up points toward visits to other Caesars properties, particularly in Las Vegas. But if people want to go elsewhere around the world, Caesars is the largest casino company in the world. The Ameristar Casino East Chicago is part of the Penn National Gaming Incorporated Casino Network, and they've got the strongest network of regional casinos around the country. They've got, the most number of casinos outside of Vegas and New Jersey, but not absolutely positive about that. But again, you've got the opportunity to build up points in different casinos that are part of the Penn National Network, and to be able to work between those different properties. So those kinds of things tend to be pretty important to the casino patron when they're looking at where to gamble, and different kinds of options and the ability to build up rewards and to use them in other places is very helpful. Now, if you look at the options that the four communities, maybe even five communities, if you consider the Homewood and East Hazelcrest, I think all but one of them deal with Native American tribes that don't have extensive networks around the country, don't necessarily have the same kind of options for Players Club, Rewards Club points, and may not be quite as appealing to potential patrons just on that basis alone.
In following the gaming community in Indiana and the legislatures, is there any concern with the legislators down in Indianapolis area of a possible Chicago casino taking away revenue from Northwest Indiana? Because a drop in Northwest Indiana revenue means a drop for the whole state.
Absolutely, and it's always been a concern, but Indiana did not react to some other concerns that had been evinced over the years, particularly when Ohio started making noises about adding casinos and then racinos. We did not respond in kind, even though legislators were given warnings. You know, they were very happy with the way things were at the time, and the state had kind of gotten fat and lazy and believed that some of those revenues would continue, and even if they didn't continue at the levels that they were at, that they were still sufficient, and we weren't quite ready for expansion back then. Times changed. We saw the Cincinnati market casinos in Indiana take a, you know, a good 25% to 30% hit from the Ohio racinos and land-based casinos. We saw the casino in the Indiana Louisville area and that market take a big hit when Churchill Downs introduced historical horse racing machines, which are kind of the equivalent of the video gaming terminals at a big facility in Louisville, just near the track. And as a result, the Horseshoe Casino down there decided to go land-based as a response to that. And now, with respect to the northern Indiana casinos, after the Native American tribe opened a casino in South Bend, and you know they saw the effects of the insidious video gaming terminals in Illinois, you know, they've made some changes. They've allowed the Gary casinos to kind of consolidate and go land-based off the footprint. They've changed the tax rate for the casinos to make them, you know, more financially viable. And they've also changed some of the other related tax laws to allow additional deductions for what you and I would call free play. The casinos refer to it as complimentary play, where they might offer coupons or coin, actual dollars, to patrons to come in and wager those, you know, essentially on house money. They didn't want those to be taxed twice. And Ohio lets their casinos have an unlimited amount of free play deductions, and Indiana's gradually increased the cap on free play, but that's also a way to give the casinos another marketing tool to bring in people, particularly from out of state.
I had an earlier conversation with the mayor of Hammond a few weeks ago, and I was telling him that, you know, there was a point where you got upset with Gary because Gary is now being able to move one of their licenses. But, you know, you're also having to deal with like a Chicago casino potentially, and now one in Homewood, or maybe one right next door in Calumet City. So is it really fair for him to be upset with Gary? Because markets change. The casino's been over there 20 years. You can't expect the market to stay exactly the same forever.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think immediately after the legislature passed the authorization legislation for the off-footprint move for Gary, you know, Mayor McDermott kind of relaxed his stance and said, hey, look, you know, I just had to defend my community, and, you know, Mayor Karen knows it's nothing personal, and she knows that I had to take the stance that I take. And, you know, sometimes I'm a little bit more dramatic than, you know, people might want me to be, but, you know, this is me, and this is the way that I look out for my community. So I'm sure he told you the same thing. And, you know, that's Mayor Tom.
Ed Feigenbaum follows gaming in the Midwest for Indiana Insight Newsletter with Hannah News Service. Coming up, the U.S. EPA has its sights on cleaning up a long polluted site on the far southeast side of Chicago, but some environmentalists aren't holding their breath it's going to happen anytime soon. Stay with us. Welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Puente. Slag is a byproduct of the steelmaking process. It has a glassy, rock-like form, tons of it were used to fill in areas of Indiana Harbor in East Chicago. But sometimes it's just an eyesore, such as the case of property at 126th Street and Avenue O on the southeast side of Chicago on the west side of Wolf Lake, just blocks from Hammond, Indiana. It's known as the Shroud property, and it's been used to store slag from the old Republic Steel Company, later known as LTV, from the 50s to the 70s. Tom Shepard is a longtime member of the Southeast Environmental Task Force, which has been fighting and monitoring environmental issues in both Chicago and Northwest Indiana for years. Tom, what can you tell me about this Shroud property that the U.S. EPA has now placed on its Superfund list? I understand that a study came out recently by the Illinois EPA showing there's lead, chromium, and other inorganic compounds on the property.
Very comprehensive study out there, and found that it's affecting the water up and down the Calumet River, where Indian Creek comes out of Wolf Lake and travels through the Shroud property and picks up all kinds of heavy metals and cadmium and chromium and so many things that you'll find in that study that migrate then both ways into the Calumet River. And, they went down the river and saw that it goes far south when the water's traveling that way, and then up north it goes north when how the Calumet River sometimes goes different directions. So it's really a heavily polluted site. We fought, the Southeast Environmental Task Force fought for years downtown with the city of Chicago, the Board of Health, the Illinois EPA, the U.S. EPA, and everyone had been throwing up their hands for years and years and saying, we just can't do anything with this guy. He's a bad actor. This guy, Shroud, it's been a couple of years now. I even forgot his first name. But he was a slippery guy, they tried to get him to clean up for years and years and years, and a number of promises that he made, he never delivered on anything. And I guess the ownership, went into tax arrears, and nobody wanted the property. The county didn't want it. The city didn't want it. The U.S. EPA didn't want it. And, who's going to step up and take responsibility? Well, now it's finally, after they've proven that it's a danger to the community and to the environmental health of the people in Heglish and the southeast side there, that it got onto the Superfund site ranking. So, but how long it's going to take before anything happens over there is another question. Properties get put on the Superfund site and unless it's a real emergency, sometimes it can languish there for quite a while before any kind of action takes place. But I hope that's not the case.
So Superfund doesn't necessarily mean we're going to run out and clean this up right now.
Right, yeah. Now, unlike the spills out at Arcelor and U.S. Steel and stuff like that where they've got a fish kill, and everybody panics when something like that occurs and action takes place pretty quick. But this year it's been sitting like that for so long, Michael, that I hope something takes place soon. And I should mention, because you asked, that the Shroud property is roughly 126th Street South on Avenue O. And I believe it's 96 acres that's out there, Mike.
Do you hope one day that if they were to clean up this property that they could use it for something, that it could be part of some new development?
Yeah, well, it's possible. Other steel properties or former steel properties have been. This one has, tons and tons and tons of slag on it, and a lot of that, the heavy metals and stuff that's contained in slag has migrated into the ground there. So it's going to take a massive amount of money to clean it up, and especially to bring it up to standards for human safety. So, but, you know, it's been pitched as a possible place for, if they were to cover it and make a kind of a bike park out there, or what do you call for those all-terrain vehicles and stuff, because they're the ones that have been using it for years now to their own, you know, their own detriment. But and I guess there's a need for a place like that, you know, just like Big Marsh, to accommodate dirt bikers and BMX racing and stuff like that. And you know, if they can make it safe enough where it's not emitting particles into the air, if they were to cover it and cap it or something like that and make a ATV park out of it, I guess that would be a potential use.
Tom Shepard is with the Southeast Environmental Task Force. Coming up, bears, bulls, and blackhawks. Oh, my.
They'll just let this thing now run all the way down. You either win it or you lose it. This will be the final play of the game. Snap, hold, kick is wide left. And the Chargers have come to Chicago and beaten the Chicago Bears by a final score of 17-16.
If you're a Chicago sports fan, things have been looking a little bleak lately. The Bulls have stumbled out of the gate. So have the Blackhawks and the Bears. Well, it's just been terrible. The team is on a 3-game losing streak, and another run at the playoffs seems pretty unlikely. We're joined by longtime sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm good. And yourself?
Fantastic. Well, I'm still eating all this Halloween candy and getting over of all the spooky stuff. But I'm going to tell you right now, Cheryl, there's nothing more spooky or scary than the Chicago Bears. What is happening with this team? It's scary. They can't score any points. Are they afraid of the end zone?
You know what? When the fact that they could not get in the end zone when they were in the red zone 5 times, that's kind of a concern. It's the play calling of Matt Nagy. It's the inability of the trust of Mitchell Trubisky and his offense. What was interesting, what Matt Nagy did before Thursday's practice, he showed his players a PowerPoint presentation of how the Washington Nationals, who were down and out, what everyone thought in May, were able to come back and win the World Series. So he's trying to use the Washington Nationals as a motivation for the Chicago Bears. I found that very interesting.
Right, right. I just don't, you know, if they can't, you know, hit a field goal, I don't think they, right. I don't put much trust in them in hitting curveballs and fastballs.
Well, you know, what was interesting about that situation with Eddie Pinheiro was, you know, he missed the field goal. We talked to him afterwards. He, you know, he owned up to it. When we talked to him on Tuesday when he was available, he said that he was asked by Dan Wiederer of the Chicago Tribune, actually did an excellent job of, you know, cross-examining him, asked him of like, where would you want that, you know, as far as placement, the ball on the left half hash where it was at or where? And he said center. And he realized that he kind of brought to the top that there was not quite a great communication between what he wanted and what he ended up doing. So that's got to be taken care of. You can't have issues, you know, if your kicker's not comfortable. You can't have a quarterback who actually was okay, just not good enough, missing open receivers like Taylor Gabriel. They did establish the run game again. That was really important because that's something that they didn't do. David Montgomery had a very good game. But, you know, when they play Philadelphia on Sunday, they're going to meet an offensive line that's very hard to penetrate, and that's what the defense has to do. But they also have to expose the safety and the cornerbacks that the Philadelphia Eagles have, and that's Mitchell Trubisky being able to throw to his receivers and get big yards.
What should we look for in this upcoming Sunday's game against the Philadelphia Eagles? Obviously, they have Jordan Howard, who's the former Chicago Bears running back. What else should we look for?
That's going to be interesting to see how they handle. They know Jordan Howard. They know what he can and can't do. So they'll key on him. I think the Bears defense really wants to set the tone against an offense that they did face in the playoffs, and they did lose in the playoffs too. So there's a lot of motivation with that. And again, Mitchell Trubisky has to get a play calling out of Matt Nagy that fits the schemes. He's got to be more decisive. He's got to make the right decisions. And that offensive line, we did find out that they can block for the running back. It has to continue. And Matt Nagy has to now wonder, is he the right person making the play calling? Should maybe his offensive coordinator be doing that? We'll find out on Sunday if they've made the right adjustments. When I look at what's going on with Matt Nagy right now, a lot of people are finger pointing at him. This is the second year in the league. Last year, people didn't know how he could call games. Now the league knows him. And the other factor is he's got a first-place schedule. So things are tougher for him, and this is when he's going to have to rise to the occasion too.
But should fans like me who get on the teams and everything really need to kind of like sit back and say, hey, look, this could be a sophomore slump on his part. He's learning how to be a head coach, and you just can't, you know, he's not going to go anywhere in terms of as a head coach. We're with him for better or for worse, so to speak, and we just need to let this guy, you know, adjust to his growing pains.
Yeah, and he has to be able to prove that he can make those adjustments. That's something. He's got the learning curve, just like Ryan Pace had as a general manager, just as Mitchell Trubisky as a quarterback. But, you know, when you only have 16 games to prove your point, when you came off a 12-4 season, when you have all that, expectations were there. I asked Prince Amukamara on Tuesday, I asked him, I said, are you stunned by what's going on? And he said, probably more disappointed, because they all knew that where they could go. And it's going to be quite a slug, because they're last place, Michael, in the NFC North.
Well, it is going to be interesting. But, you know, that's not the only scariest thing in Chicago sports scene. But that's not the scariest thing on the Chicago sports scene. We've seen already, just to open the season, both the Chicago Bulls and the Blackhawks seem to be struggling right now. What's happening with the Bulls?
You know, actually, both teams have a similar problem. Their defense. The defense for the Bulls cannot maintain four periods yet. That's something that they have to fix. And the young players have got to be able to play every minute as being important. And one thing is, you know, I think Jim Boylan is still trying to figure out, you know, his matchups, you know, especially in the fourth quarter, is because if you leave, Chris Dunn's a great defensive player, but he does turn the ball over. Zach LaVine, sometimes he gets a little selfish and it's one-on-one basketball. He can't do that. So it's a matter of not having the right players at the right time doing things for Jim Boylan and what he needs to do. And if they don't improve, it's going to be kind of curious what they're going to end up doing. I mean, do they have to start all over? It is very early. We do have to admit to that. One of the problems that the NBA did in the last collective bargaining agreement, they reduced the number of preseason games, and they reduced the amount of training camp time. So it's very hard to really get everything in place quickly the way they have to do it. But if these players don't lose the confidence in the coaching staff and Jim Boylan, if the players can, you know, listen, learn, and effectively do their job, they could be okay. But right now, it just doesn't look good at all. And with the Blackhawks, their defense is in real trouble. Brent Seabrook has been sat down. He's not even on the ice anymore because he's too slow. They are a slow team. They used to be one of the fastest teams in the league. They're now one of the slowest teams in the league. And their goalies, the other night, Robin Leonard had 48 shots. Actually, no, I'm sorry, wrong. 51 shots at him. 51 shots. And that's what happened last year. And you cannot have your goalie, if it's Crawford or if it's Leonard, be pelted like that. So they got to fix that. And, you know, you're not seeing Jonathan Toews, you know, be Jonathan Toews. And you're not seeing, you know, Duncan Keith being Duncan Keith. So this team has a lot of trouble right now. And it's very hard to fix it the way things are going, because they are in a very tough division in the NHL.
And the World Series just wrapped up. What an exciting series. We did have a few ex-Chicago players in that series.
Let me bring up some of the Chicago players that won the World Series. General manager Mike Rizzo from Chicago started as a White Sox scout. That's how his career started. And his dad, Phil Rizzo, who is now turning 90 years old, he was a scout for the White Sox and other teams. They win the World Series with Adam Eaton, a former Sox, you know, right fielder. He wins. Davey Martinez played for the White Sox, the Cubs, and also was the bench coach for the Cubs. And Daniel Hudson was a draft pick for the White Sox. A lot of names there. Fernando Rodney also played for the Cubs.
Wow. And, you know, when you see that, are those people that just, you know, that's just the way it is? You're going to have former players from former teams, or is it just missed opportunities with those former teams?
Well, you know, when you look at what Mike Rizzo did, he's an interesting case study compared to the new generation general managers. He has more scouts than most any team in baseball. So there's a much more personal touch on what he does. He does do analytics, but he found players that fit their needs. And he is a throwback in the way rosters are built, because even though, you know, teams don't do it anymore, but he does, he likes to have his number one and two players in his lineup, which is Adam Eaton's number two, have speed and also have good on-base percentage. So you mix it with starting pitching, their pitchers go seven innings. That's their philosophy. Their philosophy that they want their pitchers to go seven innings. And in the playoffs, it's hard to do that all the time, but they are conditioned better to go long. So if you have a couple of stud pitchers like the Nationals, you have a mixture of really solid all-around players, a lineup that can produce runs without using a home run, and play defense, you win a World Series.
Today starts free agency, and we got a big name that might be heading there with the Chicago White Sox and Jose Abreu. Tell us about that situation.
Yeah, what happened is baseball teams are now, you know, fixing up their 40-man rosters, and players are declaring for free agency. And Jose Abreu did declare, and a couple other players, but he's the big name. And I don't think White Sox fans should worry too much, unless he gets his, you know, gets an offer that knocks his socks up, so to speak. I think he
no
wants
pun
to
intended.
Stay here. Jerry Reinsdorf wants him to stay here. The team wants him, you know, the players, his teammates want him to stay. I think he's going to end up signing here. I don't know what the contract is going to be, but he proved, you know, he was the RBI leader in the American League last year. He proved that he's very important to the makeup of this team, and he's a leader. But it is always interesting when you see these names come out that would be free agents.
And Cheryl, before we wrap up, David Ross is the new manager for the Chicago Cubs. How do you think that's all going to turn out?
This is going to be an interesting experiment by Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer. Could somebody without any experience in as a manager or as a coach, and we're seeing it throughout the league, can he make a team that has a flawed roster succeed? David Ross was a very good backup catcher, but once you have to make those crunch time decisions, especially the bullpen, that's going to be the tail of the tape if David Ross can be successful. And if he doesn't have a roster that doesn't have a leadoff man, doesn't have a center fielder, has some starting pitching that are aging, he's going to be for a long haul. So it's going to be interesting to see if this type of manager, David Ross, strong-willed, has no problem getting people's faces, if he can succeed or not.
You can hear all of Cheryl Ray Stout's reporting on WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks for joining us, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
Coming up, Northwest Indiana celebrates Dia de los Muertos. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Without question, Halloween felt more like Christmas yesterday with all the snow and blowing winds. You can hardly make out all those ghosts and goblins trick-or-treating. But before you pack up that mask, there's a new tradition that downplays the scary part of death and instead celebrates it. Dia de los Muertos is a tradition started in Mexico that's gaining popularity thanks to part of the Disney movie Coco.
But my all-time favorite, it's
Remember Me.
Though I have to say goodbye,
Remember Me.
Don't let
really make you cry. For even if I'm far away, I hold you in my heart. I sing a secret song to you each night we are apart. Remember,
he lived the kind of life you dream about.
Me.
Until 1942, when he was crushed by a giant bell. I want to be just like him.
And that's from the Disney movie Coco. Well, we are in the midst of Dia de los Muertos, but what is it? Several local groups are hosting events today and throughout the weekend, including at Indiana University Northwest in Gary from 5 to 9 p.m. in their Gallery of Contemporary Art. Earlier this week, I attended a celebration at Purdue University Northwest in Hammond to experience the sounds of Dia de los Muertos. Take a listen.
Rachel Pollack.
I'm Elizabeth Rodriguez. We work in the College of Humanities, Education, and Social Sciences, and I'm the assistant to the dean, who is Elaine Carey.
So tell me about this great Dia de los Muertos event. What is it about, and who came up with the idea?
We wanted to do something during Hispanic Heritage Month. And then, you know, this kind of comes right after that, and so we just thought, you know, why not do something Day of the Dead?
So what's all involved here tonight?
Well, we have obviously the mariachi band, which you are hearing. We had some face painting. We had some student groups come in and create altars. And we had our one of our professors from our World Languages office come in and give just some detail about what the altars meant to the student groups and what they represent. We also had cookie painting for smaller kids, obviously the face painting, which some of us adults are enjoying.
I still need to get over and get mine done.
Yeah. And so we're just really excited that the community around us has really come in and enjoyed this event, which, you know, was supported by our chancellor's office as well with building community through the arts. So we've really tried to reach out to the Hispanic community, and we saw really great results this evening.
Is this the first time you've had something like this?
We've had several events, but we've done poetry slams here. Rachel is probably a little more familiar with all the different events we've had.
I would say the closest event to something like this that we've done, back in 2016, we did a Fiesta Latina that was around Cinco de Mayo or so. But we haven't done anything like this really involving the Hispanic community in a few years. So we really, like I was saying, with us becoming an emerging Hispanic serving institution, we really wanted to reach out to those external communities that we serve and you know, have an event that we could really celebrate and bring in the families and things like that. So this is the first time in a while that we've done something like that. Like Liz was mentioning, we've really been doing the poetry slams during Black History Month.
What have you learned about Dia de los Muertos?
I learned that it's not a sad event. I've learned that it's really about honoring and being respectful and joyous and carrying on those lives, you know, that have been lost into the future, and just really holding them close to your heart and celebrating them. And I've also learned that the one singer in the mariachi band, who happens to be our student worker, her name is Martha Gallegos, has got an amazing voice. So I'm so excited about that too.
She's a beautiful singer.
Yes.
You think this works well in tandem with, say, the American tradition of Halloween?
I think it gives a nice little offset balance, maybe a different perspective. Yes, but different.
Right, because it's two totally different takes on it, right?
Right.
Because like Liz was saying, this really is like a celebration. You know, it's like a celebration. It's also honoring the dead, you know? It's like it's a celebration of their life, too, you know?
All right. I think that's all I have, but is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I really appreciate you coming out, and I just want to acknowledge again Chancellor Peon and Dean Elaine Perry for being extremely supportive to our ideas and supporting these events.
My name is Yvonne Postelmans.
What makes Dia de los Muertos so special for you?
Well, actually, that's a long story, but the fact is that I'm a first generation here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So we were never taught the Dia de los Muertos for us, but we had seen it a lot with other families. Mm-hmm. And so to us, we found out that Dia de los Muertos was when we actually remember our loved ones. The biggest thing that helped me out was Coco, the movie Disney Coco. That really helped me out in knowing what exactly what the Dia de los Muertos was. For us, having pictures of our loved ones in an altar with their favorite foods and flowers and colors is the number one thing that we would like to do, is to share that with others, that when it's a day like this, it's everybody should share in all the cultures.
And how does it, is it on a specific one day? Is it Friday or is it like several days?
To us, it's several days, because what I'm finding out that here in the United States, since we just don't have, like in Mexico, a Saturday or Friday, mm-hmm. Here we try to structure it whatever day that we have open. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the good part about it. So to us, we're doing it on Sunday. Some people do it on Saturday, and some people do it on Friday. I believe Friday is the day of the children, you know, and this is when families go to the cemeteries and decorate and clean the tombs and things like that, and put flowers and pictures and food and things like that. Unfortunately, we can't do that here in the United States, mm-hmm. but in Mexico, it's known. In fact, one of my friends went to Oaxaca, and she said it was the most beautiful event she's ever seen.
So what, if you were to ask somebody, like, what's the difference between Dia de los Muertos and, say, Halloween?
Well, Dia de los Muertos, everybody really enjoys that. It's a day that everybody can color their faces, families get together, actually make an altar. Halloween pretty much is like everybody in scary costumes going after you. And it's just about candy. You know, really, there's no significance behind it. I mean, I love Halloween. I love giving candy to kids. But I think Dia de los Muertos is a little bit more richer in culture and should be shared with the community.
You think more non-Mexicans are going to start to gravitate towards Dia de los Muertos?
I think they are. I think they are. A lot of my non-Hispanic friends have been looking at this. In fact, going to another country to actually see how it's done, I mean, they kind of miss that here. Mm-hmm. And I think that Dia de los Muertos is going to become bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're going to be having more events like this.
My name is Rosalia Leal. And I am from, I'm originally raised in Chicago.
I asked Rosalia, tell me more about the alteras, the altars, and the ofrendas, the offerings that you put on the altars.
First of all, it's your family, your friends, that you want to remember, that you want them to come back and see that you are honoring their memory. There's food, their favorite food, favorite toys, favorite hobbies, religious articles. There's a lot of things like the flowers, the marigolds. The marigolds are very important because each offering signifies something. You need a marigolds, a lot of marigolds. You need an arch. You need a cross. You need water to quench their thirst. You need their foods. What else? You need salt. You need...
What's the salt for?
The salt signifies purity of their soul or something. So it's like as they come back that day, you know, in spirit, there's the water, the salt. Everything has to do with just purifying and giving them energy and stuff like that. Yeah. So there's a very good... I read about it, but I can't remember each and everything. And I'm going to do cards on my altar to show what every single thing, like flowers, water, salt, incense, too, from, you know, dust in a form of a cross. Yeah, there's a lot of little things that go in the making, and they all have some kind of significance.
Well, tell me about Sunday. What's happening Sunday?
So Sunday, basically, the Day of the Dead is celebrated on the 1st and 2nd. It starts from the 31st to the 1st, and then into the 2nd, from All Saints Day to All Saints Days to All Souls Days. And so in those 2 days, that's when supposedly the spirits and come back and you sell it, and you're waiting for them in a very spiritual way with all these offerings. So a lot of times the altars are made at homes on those 2 days, or they're made a big celebration in the graveyards. So in their graveyards, they bring sometimes the food and the music, like mariachi and band and whatever favorite music of that person, they come and serenade at the graveyard site. So it's a big feast of celebration, and it's different where we here celebrate Halloween as a fearful day. In our tradition, it's more the Day of the Dead. It's more of a celebration of life and spirit and soul.
Are you happy that it's catching on a lot more in the United States?
You know, there's a lot more awareness, and I think because of the movies that have come around with Disney and the diversity with, different celebrations and different holidays, I think that has brought more awareness, because before you wouldn't see the costumes of the Katrina and the Katrin and the face painting and all that stuff, because that was very popular always in Mexico, but in here it wasn't much, celebrated. So now I think it's a big thing. Now I think it's more aware, the awareness of that date. Here, I think, we're seeing a lot more celebrations, just like the Cinco de Mayo has exploded.
Right. It seems better, though, than Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah, yeah. And here, I think it's more, tied to not only traditions, but I think it's tied to more of a religious belief, because it is very Christian, Catholic, celebration. I mean, I think if you're a Catholic, you would have heard of the Día de los Muertos, how it's celebrated, right. You know what I mean? In Latin America overall. So.
Bueno. Well, that's all the time we have today for Off Mic. I'd like to thank my producers, the fabulous D. Dotson, and El Hombre, Jose Rodriguez, and of course, Tom Maloney. You can hear this show in its entirety at lakeshorepublicradio.org. You can catch me the rest of the week on WBEZ in Chicago. And for me, Michael Puente and Lakeshore Public Radio, thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.